Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to Expanding Mind, the Progressive Radio Network show where we get into exploring what consciousness is, how it grows, where it comes from, and all that fun stuff. This is your host, Maja Daou. Eric Davis will not be joining us today. Sadly, he will be missed, but he should be back next week, so we'll look forward to hearing from him then. Today, we're going to be talking about an aspect of consciousness studies, which I love, of course, due to the nature of a lot of my work, which is how ideas of esotericism and occultism can infiltrate popular culture and break through into our conscious minds. And I've always been very interested in looking at movements, whether they are done through artists or musicians or writers, and how they'll just be small groups of people. Sometimes it doesn't have to be more than even two individuals who will get together and, you know, either write manifestos or make an album or create art, which will invigorate these ideas of ancient occult symbolism into popular culture and reach huge audiences, especially the young people. You know, certainly old people are included as well, but there's a lot of consciousness shifts that will reinvigorate these ideas in kind of the youth culture. And most times it's done through these kind of artistic avenues. So I always get really into looking at the individuals who can help reinvigorate that. And certainly that's what I try to do in a lot of the work that I do, is kind of look at getting these ideas back out to people and recirculating them and keeping them alive in our consciousness. And today we're going to be speaking with a guest who I feel like is doing that same thing. We're going to be talking with Mickey Pellerino, who does a lot of different artistic endeavors. He does pretty much every single one of the things that I was just talking about. He does music and performance art and writing. So he's working on infiltrating the occult in all of those different areas. So I'm very excited to be speaking with him today. Mickey, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks. Thanks so much for doing the show. I just am really excited to hear about, you know, some of the ways that you like to influence a culture. So I thought maybe we could start out by talking a little bit maybe about some of the performance art you do, because I'm always very fascinated by live performances that people do, and it looks like even some of the ones that you've done were in kind of interesting situations. So I was wondering, do you do that with like the same group of people when you do your performances, or is it kind of different people each time?
I suppose it's different people each time, but there's definitely a core of people that I that are usually really willing to work with me, and they've been in several of them, so I'm really grateful for that.
And do you guys have like is it like a group or just a bunch of friends? Have you guys like had meetings about it, or is it more informal?
It's more informal. It's really just whenever one of these performances comes up, I sort of contact people either who I know will be willing to be a part of it, or people who sort of would be appropriate to play certain roles in the performances, I guess magically speaking or archetypally speaking.
Right. And, I mean, it looks like most of the performances are totally archetypal and kind of draw on many of these mysterious occult ideas, like, you know, some of the titles are The Rites of Acadia or Chimaea of Venus and Furs. You know, it looks like you infiltrate a lot of those kinds of ideas, even like Masonic rituals, it looks like you do. Can you talk about maybe how you got inspired to do some of these occult ritual performances?
Well, it varies. Usually it's either one of two things. Either the person or group or event that asked me to do the performance has a certain theme already in mind, so I sort of tailor the performance to that theme I'll give you an example. Like there was an event that had to do with, it was a prehistoric themed event, right?
Mm.
So we did a ritual performance that was sort of based on hunting rituals that the cavemen would do, sort of, where they would reenact the hunt and have somebody represent the animal being hunted, and those rituals are depicted on cave paintings and things like that. So we emulated that in order to, sort of accommodate the theme. Otherwise, the other thing is oftentimes if there's just a ritual that I'm sort of wanting to do in my life, or something that I feel like I need, or something I feel like my community needs, if I'm given the freedom to do whatever I choose, then I sort of just kind of choose a magical intent and then make a ritual based around that.
Mm. And what are some of the reactions that you've gotten from people when you do these very ritualistic performances? Do you find that what are some of the reactions you get from the audience? Do you feel like they get drawn into it and involved as well, or do people freak out?
No, I mean, in general, I think people are really, at least what, the sort of feedback people give me is generally really positive. I think people really enjoy it. It's rare, I think it's really common to sort of go out and see a band or something like that, and less common to go see bands and you sort of have a theatrical event at the same time or a ritualistic event at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes for art galleries. I kind of feel like a lot of the performance art that goes on in art galleries can be kind of alienating, or can be sort of private joke oriented, and my background is in experimental theater, and I've done a lot of theater, so I think that primarily my performance pieces are theatrical and therefore take entertainment into account. I try to keep them short enough that the audience can stay engaged, and I try to keep them colorful enough and exciting enough and erotic enough that it'll please people depending on what atmosphere we find ourselves in. So generally speaking, I think I get a pretty positive reaction. I feel really grateful for that too.
Oh, that's good. And what do you do it like mostly in theaters, or do you do it like on the street and different kinds of places?
Normally, I either do it at either musical events, like sort of events where sort of there's performances, bands playing and things like that, or in art gallery settings normally. We have done a few outside, but that's just because, either the gallery asked us to do it outside or the event was outside, but normally they're within one of those two contexts.
Mm. Well, see, I just love that because it's almost like people might be going to see a rock show or an art show, and maybe they don't really have any idea what they're in for unless they kind of, know what you're doing. But do you feel like it kind of takes some people by surprise when they see what you're doing?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I know we had a really strong reaction to one that we did that was sort of voodoo based. It actually was a kind of a combination art exhibition and a band played. I'm friends with this band, Golden Triangle,
mm-hmm.
and they did this really awesome score for the performance. And we did this sort of voodoo zombie ritual where we like revived this dead girl with using the heart of a dead eel, to sort of revive the. And that got a really strong reaction. I think people were kind of freaked out to actually see a creature there. But I did buy the eel dead, so I didn't murder any animals for the
right.
for the performance. I sort of went to Chinatown and saw this poor dead eel floating in the tank, and I just bought that one, But as far as shocking reactions, I feel like maybe that's the only one where I felt a strong shock. I mean, the thing about ritual and magic is I suppose to me it seems very commonplace and it seems very normal. So if people are shocked by it, I sort of don't realize it. You know what I mean? Because to me, magic is sort of happening all the time and everywhere.
Well, I totally agree. I mean, it's the same for me too. And I think when you kind of live in that space, that becomes your reality. But what I find is when you do performances in front of people, I mean, a lot of these people don't live their lives with that kind of consciousness. And to me, like, that's how the kind of performances that you do are able to break it into people's consciousness. You know, when they witness a kind of ritual performance that you're doing, you're essentially opening their perception to that fact that the magic is there all the time. You know, so that's why I was just curious, like, what kind of reactions you get from the audience, because, you know, oftentimes when people don't live in places where their consciousness is expanded to that idea of magic and they can witness magic firsthand in front of them, you know, they can have sort of severe reactions sometimes.
Yeah, well, I certainly hope that my performances are opening people's mind in that way, definitely. But I also try to present it in such a way that it's sort of theatrical and entertaining enough that it sort of, you know, they can sort of experience it from a spectator's point of view, almost as though they're watching a play of sorts. You know what I mean? So I try not to be too hardcore, but I suppose some people do have a strong reaction. I remember I did an art show in Mexico City and sort of decorated kind of made an installation around the drawings that I showed that was mm-hmm. things that I had bought at the Sonora Market, which is a lot of Santeria
right.
Materials and things. And I remember people being kind of like, whoa, like, this is really witchy and shocking. And I'm like, really? It seems so average. But for the most part, I have to say, I get a pretty positive reaction. And I think people are actually really willing and open to experience magic and really excited by the idea of magic, at least in the community that I work in. So
right.
that's a good thing.
That's wonderful. And I had noticed, I was thinking a lot about it too, because I noticed that you have mentioned that Maldoror and Lautremont are kind of big influences on you. And I love Lautremont as well. I got exposed to Maldoror several years ago, and it was at a time when I was also synchronistically researching surrealism and like the fantomas and stuff like that. And I know that I got really interested in like your performances as well, just because the Maldoror influenced the Situationists a lot, who of course were performance artists as well that would, you know, just kind of do it wherever and try and open people's consciousness that might not have ever thought about some of these things. And I was just curious if, like, how that kind of influenced some of your performances, or if that those ideas that he brings up in Maldoror, like, did that kind of inform any of the things that you do?
It's hard to say exactly where Maldoror specifically has influenced me, because it was such a huge thing. I mean, if you talk about opening people's minds, you know, I've studied a lot of magic and Kabbalah and things like that, and I feel like wrapping your mind around concepts that are so abstract and so large is an exercise in and of itself to open the mind, you know, just to intellectually grasp something that's so involved and has so many layers of symbolism and has such a, you know, divine order of representation. I think if there are exercises that can stretch the capacity of your mind, I think reading those sorts of things is definitely that. And Maldoror, for sure, was something to that effect for me. I mean, it really just, I had never read anything like it. And even though it is so base and so vile and morbid at the same time, there's such a sense of like divinity and holiness that's enshrined in all of that gore and sadism, you know, that to me was just really mind blowing. I think in the Wiesmond, Labat in that book,
uh-huh.
which, you know, I mean, he's an author, I'd say, one of the symbolist / decadent authors, a lot like Lautremont. In
right.
that book, he says how Gilles de Rais, kind of, his psyche was forced into such, like, base, like, bestial acts, because even though he worked alongside Joan of Arc, and he said that once the mind is exposed to such divinity and such holiness as he was alongside Joan of Arc, that the pendulum sort of has to swing the other way, and your psyche is driven into this like perversity. You know, he just became insatiable for violence and transgression and things like that. So I think that whole movement of authors really had a lot to do with that, sort of finding a connection or a bridge between what is base and what is divine, you know?
I think that's very true. And I think, you know, one of the schisms that we experience today is when people are only trying to get into, like, the light stuff with all the New Age movement, and then the shadow world becomes even more obscured. And when people don't delve into that shadow side of themselves, then we get, like, an entire population of people on antidepressants and things like that.
So I agree.
You know, I think that those authors, and for me, like, I'm a big fan of all that stuff, and, like, Baudelaire is one of my favorite poets, and, like, that whole movement was just tremendous to me. And when I was researching surrealism, like, as a movement, again, like, you look at the surrealist movement, a bunch of artists talk about people that had an effect on the shift of people's consciousness. So I was trying to, like, figure out, like, what some of the roots of it were. And, of course, they were all looking at the alchemical material, which, I mean, that's that balance of as above, so below, right? You have to just not look at the light, but also the below part. And in tracing it back, like, invariably, that book, Maldoror, seemed to inform the majority of the surrealist movement. It was kind of like the root. A lot of people put it as the root for many of that takeoff. So it was almost like, it's funny that you're talking about the base, because it really kind of did form that lower bottom base that then the surrealists were able to enter into that kind of darker part of consciousness in a parameter and able to expand upon it.
Yeah, and I don't even know if Le Tremont was familiar with alchemy or things like that. I mean, he may be. It's obvious that he was incredibly educated, but it's funny. The surrealists drew on Le Tremont so much, and at the same time, they were so obsessed with alchemy. I mean, you know, Duchamp and Dalí, and, you know, finding divinity in the base, how Dalí's famous quotes of how excrement are akin to gold in the subconscious, and how he used excrement and filth as a means to expand his consciousness and be able to access genius or divinity.
Yeah, I mean, that just even, like, a lot of people don't know that, and in a lot of Dalí's works, he was so into alchemy, and he even did, like, an entire journal on his alchemical studies, which is a little less known. They actually published some of his, like, alchemical sketches, which was all, you know, going into that material, but it's a little more obscure. And when you, I always think it's very interesting that this surrealist movement, which is, to most people, they look at it, and, you know, on the surface, it's become popular as kind of like, ooh, it's psychedelic or druggy, or, you know, it gets kind of like some of those connotations, or like dreamlike or whatever. But really, when you investigate it and look at the base, it is this entire occult esoteric movement that was able to infiltrate those ideas into people's consciousness through their artwork in a way that was accessible to people and maybe not as horrific as Maldoror per se, you know. But then you look at, like, another influence of it is the Fantomas, which was, like, the French group of authors that wrote horror novels and, like, you know, murder mystery type.
Oh, yeah, Marcel Alain and Pierre Souvestre.
Exactly. And, I mean, they did. It was kind of a little bit similar in the baseness of Maldoror, but it did it in such a way that was, they would look at the horrific, you know, acts of murder and things like that and take it into a more conscious, expanding way. And that was also a big influence on a lot of the surrealists at the time, which I think is very interesting that they were kind of informed by this violent darkness. It was, like, the biggest inspiration for a lot of those artists.
Well, I think the Fantomas novels are sort of an extension of Maldoror directly. In fact, I read somewhere this essay comparing the characters of Phantomas and Maldoror and how similar they are. Like, they're
interesting.
They're sort of both shapeshifters, you know.
Yeah.
They're sort of both like half human and half like demigod, sort of, and they both, like, you know, are embodiments of evil, and I wish I could remember more clearly. I believe it's in the introduction to The Corpse Who Kills, which I think is the third Phantomas book.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think, Maldoror is a very esoteric book, and it's a really difficult book. And what I think that the Alain and Souvest, their books sort of brought those aspects of Maldoror and made them palatable to a more mainstream audience, you know?
Absolutely.
And in so doing, I mean, they really created the template for sort of pulp novels and horror novels and mystery novels, like, in a pop culture atmosphere, which is pretty awesome.
Well, yeah, I mean, those were basically hailed as the first pulp fiction, you know. I mean, that's kind of where it started. If you look through literature history, those were exactly the first pulp novels in existence. And to me, it's very fascinating that the first pulp fictions were, you know, of this extremely esoteric and occult and violent nature. And that's, you know, what started the entire, like, pulp fiction movement afterwards, and that was the stem of it. And there was, I love the book, I always talk about it, but there's a great book by Gary Lachman called Turn Off Your Mind, and he kind of, like, tries to get into the roots of where, you know, occultism influences different parts of pop culture, either through music or books, and he goes through and you can trace, like, these consciousness shifts, and he does it in the 60s, to, like, specific books that come out. And sometimes it'll just be, like, one book that's responsible, you know, for an entire shift of the way that everybody thinks. Hmm. And he looks at it, like, as different kind of pulp novels. He looks at a lot of the, like, H.P. Lovecraft and stuff like that, and the degree of influence that they're able to have on huge communities of people's consciousness, and it's really just kind of outstanding.
Yeah, I mean, Lovecraft is I don't even think he knew what he was channeling. I've actually read things that they say that Lovecraft actually, through his family, had access to really arcane Masonic literature.
And yeah, totally.
Yeah, and so possibly he was introduced to the you know, the really hardcore esoteric ritual magic, and that sort of may have influenced, you know, how he could have channeled all that stuff into there. But Phantomas, it's so funny how they, you know, another thing about Phantomas that I realize is Phantomas is also kind of like a, he kind of shifts sex, and there's a lot of, like, cross-dressing in the Phantomas book.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Totally.
And in Maldoror, there's not so much cross-dressing, but there's a lot of homoeroticism and pedophilia and things like that. And then, and in the surrealist movement, I really feel like they were drawing from the archetype of the androgyne, you know, and the union of opposites through male and female becoming one. Because cross-dressing was both adopted by Dali and Duchamp. They both had sort of female alter egos. You know, Duchamp had Rose Salavi, and Salvador Dali was Avida Dollars.
Yep, it's so true. And that's also shamanic as well, right? Like, part of the shamanic initiation. In several cultures, shamans actually live as women for several years. And then, of course, that's tantric as well, right? Like, Ramakrishna lives as a woman and dresses as a woman for a good part of his life. So through that aspect of the androgyn, they're also, again, like, through their artistic movements, infiltrating this totally esoteric concept into popular, you know, consciousness just by adapting those alter egos.
I know, that's, yeah, I did not know that about the shamans living as women. In what culture is that?
Most of them, in fact, in Mircea Eliade's book, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy, his big shamanism work, he outlines the cross-dressing practices that are in Siberia, in Australia, in Africa. so many different cultures, part of the shamanic initiation is that you do have to, like, kind of become an androgen. And a lot of people, of course, don't really talk about that because it's, you know, a little taboo. But they'll even live as a man's wife for several years, which I think is interesting.
That is really interesting. I've actually read accounts that in John Dee and Edward Kelly were they were, you know, the angelic beings that they were in contact with suggested that they engage in homosexual intercourse, and they as an alternative they swapped wives.
Yes.
You know, as a way of, like, sharing all things, or sort of, like, having some sort of sexual union. At least as far as it's documented, they didn't feel comfortable to actually have a sexual union themselves, so they slept with each other's wives. And
I have read, though, that that might have been a little manipulative on Edward Kelly's part, because John Dee's wife was really hot. So.
Oh, really?
thanks so much. We're talking with Mickey Pellerino. We're going to have a little break for a few minutes and hear some kind words from the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
Do you have a medical question or concern and would like to get a second opinion? If so, make sure you tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Ronald Klatz. Dr. Klatz is president and founder of the AFREM, American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, the largest physician-based anti-aging organization in the world. Each week, Dr. Klatz will talk with expert guests from the field of anti-aging, functional, and regenerative medicine. So if you want to live a longer, healthier life, tune in to Second Opinion with Dr. Klatz, Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern, here on PRN.
Hi, this is Virginia Reed, and I'll see you this Friday talking about Long Day's Journey Into Night. We'll have both the director and the main actors, both male and female. This is Virginia Reed. I'm very happy I'm back, and I can't wait to see you all this Friday again on PRN.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Expanding Mind. This is Maja Daou, and we're here speaking with Mickey Pellerino, eminent occultist, writer, artist, musician, and also filmmaker. Mickey, we were just talking a little bit about the androgen and cross-dressing, and I have tried very hard in a lot of my lectures. I give many lectures on the androgen and the hermaphrodite, and in my writing I like to reinvigorate that into people's consciousness. And I think it's interesting, too, because we're going through, obviously, this whole thing about gay marriage is a big hot topic, and just about people's receptivity to that concept of androgyny. And I always do try and remind people that we're all male and female, and that actually what happens when you're a fetus is you have both at the same time, and then one of them gets expressed depending on, you know, who kind of wins the battle of the genes in that area. And I don't know if you have done, like, any of your performance art as in cross-dress, or have you integrated that into any of your performances at all?
I haven't, actually, and at least not that I can remember any sort of cross-dressing, but it's definitely something I'd be willing to explore. And funny you should mention, because it's kind of been in the back of my mind lately as something I might want to, a theme I might want to work on.
Mm-hmm. It's hard because you get a lot of judgment from it, obviously. Like, it's kind of a big sacrifice to make in popular culture to make that move. But, I mean, obviously there's been lots of musicians and performers that have done it successfully, like, you know, David Bowie or folks like that, that have been able to really pull it off without, you know, too much restriction or ostracization and stuff like that. So, but I was just curious if you had, do you ever have, like, any of those elements with other people doing that in your performances or films or anything?
There is an artist that I do work with, or have worked with a bunch, especially in performance. His name is Raul de Nieves, and he definitely explores that, a lot of cross-dressing in his performance art, and even kind of in his day-to-day life. I mean, I feel like he's one of those rare people who can really express himself fully as a male, and yet at the same time sort of waver at this border that's not even quite drag, you know, sort of just this, like, ambiguity of his gender, which I find really beautiful and really admirable, and he carries it off very well. So sometimes in my performance work and things like that, he definitely has taken more of that role than me. I think a lot of it has to do, I've got really broad shoulders and kind of a big head, so I kind of look awkward. I kind of look awkward dressed as a woman. It doesn't really, like, suit me. I think it might kind of throw people off and draw them out of the performance, but who knows? Maybe it's something I'll be able to work on and eventually master.
Well, I don't know. Like, you can see, I mean, Mick Jagger is always someone that comes into my mind, because he's, like, someone who's not a very pretty lady, but can kind of have that very feminine aspect to himself. So I always say big kudos to dudes that can, like, pull off that feminine part of themselves without, you know, having to erupt their masculinity too far. So
I agree.
I did want to let people know about some of your films, too. Speaking about films, you've done several of them that also kind of explore very esoteric ideas, one of them being called Maldoror itself. And then just even looking through some of them with titles like Pantella, Meditations on the Number 10. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, maybe one of your favorite subject matters of one of the films that you've done?
Yeah, Pantelia is actually probably one of my favorite films, and it's that I've made, and it's sort of a meditation on the number 10 and how it's what its mystical implications are. And, you know, as anybody who studied the sacred meaning of numbers, or the sacred meaning of anything, any color, any plant, any animal, there's just layers and layers of symbolism and meaning behind pretty much anything. I mean, that's why when you're tripping, like, you have all those layers of information. Or that's why when people reach levels of yogic enlightenment, they just experience the wonder and, like, infinite meaning and divinity behind each and every thing.
Yeah.
So that movie, I think, is interesting because we just focus on the number 10. And we just delve deeper and deeper into its symbolism and its representation and why it's so important and why it's regarded as so many as it is in so many different spiritual traditions, you know.
Right. Well, it's funny because one of my favorite movies is Powers of Ten by Charles and Ray Eames. I don't know if you've seen that one.
No, I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, well, they start with, like, this couple on a picnic blanket, and then every 10 seconds they zoom out to a power of 10 till they get out, till basically you're in the universe. And then they go back to the couple on the picnic blanket, and they zoom in to the power of 10 every 10 seconds into the guy's hand, and then so you get into molecules and then eventually into the atom and into inner space. And by the time you're on the very inside, it's the same as it was on the very outside.
Wow.
And they do that using the number 10 as well. And to me, I love that because it integrates the as above, so below, and then also that it's on the power of 10 that you're able to get in and out, which obviously they must have done research on the Kabbalistic symbolism of it.
Yeah, definitely. I'd love to send you that film, actually. I think you might really enjoy it. And that's actually one of a part of a trilogy. And the first film in the trilogy was sort of a ritual that I did through cinema, meaning that I didn't, it wasn't a document of an actual ritual. It was sort of a sequence of images and alchemical slash Kabbalistic, I suppose you could say hermetic symbols, meant to sort of manipulate the alchemical process in a certain direction. And the third one in the trilogy is called Rites of Ta, which is a film that I made with my friend Sean Reagan. He's actually the front man of my band Cult of Youth, and he and I just did this really exhaustive Kabbalistic ritual, and we documented it on Super 8 film, and my friend Nate Archer did the music for it, and it was really great. And so it's kind of like looking at ritual from three different perspectives, you know, from like a purely symbolic, from an actual like, you know, earthly ritual taking place, and then also from a philosophical point, which is what Pantelia really does. And Pantelia begins in a very philosophical, it's kind of modeled after an old educational film, and it kind of starts out being really, you know, forthright and factual, but as the information in the film gets more abstract, so does the subject matter of the film, and therefore, you know, the structure and the continuity of the film starts to sort of like unravel and dematerialize and go in that direction.
That sounds fantastic. And have you noticed that, you know, by doing your films and showing them to people, what kind of reactions have you gotten? I mean, because a lot of it is just so esoteric in nature. I wonder if you've had, like, what kind of reactions from people you've gotten, if they tell you that, you know, you really kind of triggered something, or what kind of feedback you've gotten from them.
Yeah, well, my main goal as an artist, I guess, in a way, is to take notions that are abstract and esoteric and sort of present them in a way that are accessible to people, you know, that people can really get this. Like, I'm not really interested in the kind of art that alienates people or that has to do with the artist's internal struggle or the artist's autobiographical struggle. I try to put things that are universal and useful to everyone and put that forth in my films and performances. And one thing I can say for sure is Sean, my friend who I did the ritual of Rites of Ta with, our intentions for that ritual, I mean, we just got amazing results throughout the years. And I think because it's a film and because it continues to be rescreened and reviewed through the years, it's almost like the ritual is being done over and over. And therefore, the results of the ritual keep on manifesting in new ways. So film is a really powerful medium when it comes to ritual magic, just because of the repetition of it. You know what I mean? So.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why I like what you're doing so much, is because you are consciously utilizing that power. I mean, you know, there are definitely other people that have done it, like obviously Kenneth Anger being the most famous.
Oh, yeah.
For infiltrating that kind of conscious intention in ritual into his films. But, I mean, you just don't see it that often. And unfortunately, like with Kenneth Anger's work, it's taken on this, like, you know, sensationalistic affiliation where a lot of people that might not be so savvy will have sort of derogatory opinions of it when they might not really get that into what it is he's trying to accomplish, which is just that, the repetition and inclusion in the audience of the ritual. And that's why I like what you're doing, because it seems like maybe more accessible and a little bit less intimidating to people, because I think Kenneth Anger can tend to intimidate quite a few people.
Well, I hope so. Not that I hope he can intimidate people, but I hope that people find my work easy to stomach, and that people find my work, you know, accessible, and at least they can come away, even if they don't understand the ritual implications, that they can come away either benefiting from the ritual or at least enjoying some sort of inherent beauty that they find in the artwork. I really hope to, you know, at least people make people feel that.
Well, it's very difficult. And just like what we were talking about with Maldoror and the kind of violent darkness that is in there, I mean, I face that same struggle in trying to present darkness to people in a balance, you know, and encouraging people to look at the entirety of the picture and those kind of esoteric ritual things in a way that is not necessarily removing the terror and horror from things, because I think it's important to integrate that into our consciousness because it's part of reality, but just in a way that is not going to alienate them, like you were saying earlier. And it can be a very tricky thing to accomplish. And I think there's unfortunately a lot of people that just go way into the horror side and then make it all sensationalistic and kind of do it that way and forget about the beauty part of it.
I think it has a lot to do with what you mentioned earlier about how people are kind of focusing on the light so much that they disregard the darkness, and especially in the magic community. You know, I feel like there's a lot of like hatred for Aleister Crowley because of all the, you know, base things that he's known for, and that there's a lot of like fear of anything black or dark. Or I'll give you an example. I was this one girl. I heard that she read tarot cards, and friends of mine have been like, oh, you should speak to her. Mm-hmm. So I said, oh, it's cool that you read tarot cards. I was like, are you into other kinds of ceremonial magic? And she's like, oh, no, I don't get into that dark stuff. And I'm like, well, that just proves that you're uneducated, because to think of ritual magic as something dark is just completely inaccurate. I mean, it depends on how you use it. And people get stuck because they don't, you know, even people that are obsessed with horror films, they see it, I think, as something that's external from themselves.
Absolutely.
And, like, not part of what's inside of them. And what's so great about Maldoror is that it really makes you, like, reach in there, and it kind of almost makes you take pleasure in all these sadistic things and realize, like, Jesus, I must be really messed up if I can like derive so much pleasure from this kind of a thing. And but it just makes you kind of evaluate that about yourself and love that about yourself. And you know, the I Ching tells us that like I don't think the I Ching would use a word like sin, but for lack of a better word, the I Ching would say that it's a sin, or a sort of a, by sin I mean something that draws you away from divinity, to wish for a life that's free of pain.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, you know, myself included, live this life where we're like, well, gosh, I just want peace. I just want freedom from pain. I just want freedom from darkness. But really, I mean, it's like to mess up and to have faults and to have failures is human, and that's how you evolve. It's like the diamond, for example, is formed from years of like pressure and agony and heat, and alchemy teaches us the same thing. There's the stage of calcination where you're just exposed to like torturous heat, and then there's phases of putrefaction where you just die and decay. And the fact of the matter is, these things are necessary for evolution. They're necessary for spiritual evolution, and they're necessary for just learning how to love and learning how to exist and learning how to express what's really inside of you. So I think it's important that magicians and artists and moviegoers and everybody else realize, like, hey, I've got darkness inside me, and it's okay, you know?
It's so true, and it's so funny that you said all that, which you expressed very beautifully, because I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine, Amit, who runs the Steve Allen Theater here in Los Angeles, and he's very interested in horror, too, and we were just kind of talking about, like, what it is that draws people into horror, and, I mean, I was mentioning that part of it is that you do connect to it. Like when someone does good horror, it's because you have an affinity with the killer, and it is something inside of yourself which is not getting expression, right? And that's, like you said, with Maldoror, how you can take pleasure in the, you know, terrible acts that he's doing. It's because it's connecting to a part of you, right? That's, you feel sympathy and empathy for it because it's something, it's drawing from something inside of you, and it's something that most people don't like to face within themselves, so they get to do it sort of vicariously through other people when they're presented with something horrific entertainment-wise, and then they can do it kind of guilt-free as mm-hmm. well because they don't have to take responsibility for it. But I think what happens when you start getting into occultism and practical ceremonial magic is that you are taking responsibility for that within yourself, and you're starting to process it and integrate it into part of yourself. And to me, like all of these occult movements that put that idea into popular consciousness, like that is what they're trying to do. They're literally doing the alchemical process of integration because they're taking these darker concepts which are inside of people latently, and they're trying to integrate them into people's lives and bring them out to the forefront and say, look, like this is part of reality. And if you want to just like try and pretend everything is light, and like the girl that did the tarot card reading, it's just so funny because tarot card reading is ceremonial magic. So for her to say that is just so ridiculous. But
I know.
But that you have to integrate that into your life, and you can't just pretend that like everything's hunky dory and light and beautiful all the time, because then you're literally ignoring half of the world, right? If you even take it on a material level where protons are light and electrons are dark and there's plus and negative and good and evil, then you're literally ignoring an entire half of the world. So
yeah, and I think it got a lot worse with television. I mean, like before that, you read about all these like societies and like huge groups of people that had all these really esoteric interests and bizarre ideas on spirituality and health and all these other things, and really so many educated people out there. And then you go, TV sort of introduced this idea of conformity, where it's like, all right, you know, ostensibly you need to appear to the world as this like good person, and mm-hmm. you know, and there's good and there's evil, and you know, my favorite type of film is the film where like it's really hard to point out who's a villain, you know, who's
yeah.
a good guy and who's a bad guy. To me, that's the most interesting, because we're all both, you know.
Yeah.
And in psychotherapy, even, there's the process of individuation, where these, which is very related to alchemy and the androgyne and the union of opposites. I mean, it's all about integrating the parts of you that are separated and split off.
Yeah.
You know, for example, as you cited earlier, the vicarious pleasure you would see from a murderer in a horror movie. And sort of integrating them and making them part of your psychological arsenal, and really becoming one being, you know, you know, mastering those things. And that's why in, you know, Kabbalistic magic or in the style of the Golden Dawn, how, the way they propose to do it is that you achieve knowledge of your holy guardian angel, and
right.
then afterwards you practice goetic magic, which is demonic magic,
yeah.
which is the subjugating of all the entities that are demonic and chaotic inside of you, you know, making them subjugating them to your will.
Right.
So.
It's interesting that you bring up that story, because I always like to tell people and reinvigorate that part of King Solomon, because goetic magic comes from King Solomon, and he actually, the temple of the Jews was built by demons under King Solomon's instruction. Which I was like, you know, people think that the temple in Israel, like the tabernacle, was actually built by demons under his instruction. But what ends up happening to him, he had this ring which allowed him to have dominion over the demons, and he got kind of cocky, and he ended up losing it to this, you know, very big demon. His name I won't say because I'm superstitious, but the demon stole the ring and threw it into the ocean, and then King Solomon, you know, fell under the rule of the demons. And they took him over, and he becomes enslaved by them towards the end of his life, and then is only able to be released through his death when he makes a plea to God. And his story is very central to exactly what you're talking about with the psychological implications, because his story is exactly an archetypal model for the for fighting and integrating the demons within us, and that he's trying to get control over them and make them his minions, but really they're just a part of all these aspects of himself, and it's not that he has to control them, but he has to recognize them as parts of himself. And to me, that's kind of the moral of the King Solomon story, and that gets completely left out of whenever you learn about King Solomon in Sunday school or even in most of the tradition and culture. That best part of the story, which is his battle with the demons, just gets left out of popular culture entirely.
Yeah, I was totally unfamiliar with that, actually. I'm familiar with the Seals of Solomon and things like that, but I wasn't familiar with the story of the ring and the demons. And
yeah, it's in Lewis Ginsburg's Legend of the Jews, and then the Givry book, Magic, Witchcraft, and Alchemy, talks about it as well. But it's a little more left out, and I always think that those examples are things that need to be discussed, because, of course, King Solomon is revered as the most wise king ever, and people say that he's like a total holy man. I mean, even in Judaism, he's revered as a holy man that had no problems and could do no wrong. But really, the truth is, like all holy men, he was fighting his demons his whole life. So, well, Mickey, we just have a few minutes left here, and I was wondering, I wanted to talk a little bit about your band, Cult of Youth, and I think you have a performance coming up, right?
Yeah, we're going to be playing tomorrow, actually, at Don Pedro's in Brooklyn, if anybody listening is in Brooklyn. For the Sacred Bones showcase. So.
And can you talk a little bit about the music that you make and maybe kind of what your MO is for a lot of stuff you do with your band?
Yeah, I mean, I play bass in the band. Most of the music is written by my friend Sean Reagan. He's the front man, but it's funny. I mean, just as it happens, I think a lot of the influence of the band is chaos magic, really, and runic magic, and you know, mysticism in general. I mean, there's a really strong spiritual streak, I think, to the work, and I think Sean is really good at channeling that, not only in his songwriting but also in his performance. So.
Mm. And if people were to want to find out more information about that, is there a website or anything they can go check out?
Yeah, right now they could look up Cult of Youth. Right now all we have, I think, is the MySpace page. But we just came out with an EP put out by Avant Records in Italy. It's called Filthy Plumage on an Open Sea. And we just finished recording a full-length LP, which we actually may be mixing in Los Angeles. Who knows?
Oh, great.
So hopefully if we're there, maybe we can play a show or something while we're out there.
Yeah, out. Totally.
But yeah, we actually just toured the West Coast with Non. We did we played some shows with Boyd Rice up in L.A. and San Francisco and San Diego. That was back in April, and that was really great.
Oh, that does sound good. I'm sorry I missed that. And then I also really wanted to direct people to some of your writing as well. I know I was able to read an article that you wrote on plants and occultism and magic, which I thought was just fantastic, and I would really encourage any of our listeners to check out some of your writing. Is that available on your website for folks to look at, or?
I'm actually working on a blog that's dedicated only to my writing. I want to keep it separate from the artwork, but it's not up yet. That article on plants is going to be published in a book, the second volume of a book called 23, which is put out by the Heartworm Press in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
Run by Max Morton. I'm not exactly sure when it's going to be published. I think it's going to be published sometime in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I did used to write some things for Dagobert's Revenge magazine.
Uh-huh.
This is a Boyd Rice and Tracy Twyman's magazine, heavily based on conspiracy theory and, you know, Holy Blood, Holy Grail kind of stuff. But that magazine is no longer in operation, but I do believe some of the articles are online. So the best advice I could give people is, if they're interested in my writing, to please keep their eyes peeled for my blog, because it's coming soon.
Great. Will you have a link to that on your website, probably,
yep.
I imagine?
Yep. I will link it from my website for sure.
And can you tell people what your URL is for your website?
Yeah, if you're interested in looking at my artwork or stills from my films and performance pieces, the web address is www.mickeypellerano.wordpress.com, and my name is spelled MickiPellerano.
Thanks, that's awesome. If anybody wants to go find out more information, which I absolutely encourage you to do, please go check out his website. And Mickey, I just want to thank you for being on the show today, and just again to thank you for all the work that you've done. And I always get approached by people that think that occultism is kind of dying out and being left to these old fuddy-duddy Freemasons, and you know that it's only for wizards with beards. But I'm a big, you know, kind of infiltrator myself, and I want to try to get youth movements and, you know, younger people and larger consciousness movements with artists and musicians to keep expressing these ideas and keep the ideas circulating and keep people doing the work and keeping their minds open. So I just think that you do that on so many different fronts with your writing and music and performances and everything. You're just kind of taking the bull by the horns.
Well, thanks. I think you're doing a really awesome job in LA with everything you do, and I'm really honored to have been on the show. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, you're so welcome, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Likewise.
Thanks, everybody, so much for joining us today on the Progressive Radio Network. You've been listening to Expanding Mind with me, Maja Daou. We'll hopefully be joined by our other lovely host, Eric Davis, next week. If you're interested in finding out about what I do, you can look at my website, which is www.godismyboyfriend.com. I will have some events coming up. I'm going to be giving a little lecture at Pacifica Graduate University on the 20th of August, which will be on female shamans called Shameless Shamaness, about soothsayers and all that fun stuff. Thanks for joining us today, and keep your minds open.